Call our task force meeting to order, and I would just ask our clerk to take note of who is here for attendance purposes. And we also have a new member of our task force, and I would just ask if you'd like to take a moment and introduce yourself and say hello to everybody.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Queen. I'm Executive Director of Wallingford Community Daycare Center, which is a NAUYC-accredited child care facility funded by the state, in part. And I also serve on the Early Childhood Alliance and a bunch of other sort of... I'm an early childhood nut. I also have therapy dogs, and Simon is with me today. Thank you.
It's a gorgeous dog, by the way. We have a number of people who could not be here today. Dean Thomas Mitzel from Trinity, Representative Ed Vargas, Representative Lou Esposito, and David Newman. So we will make sure that they get minutes of the meeting. Today, our purpose was primarily to have an opportunity to go around the table and let individuals share thoughts in terms of information that you feel you would like the task force to gather as a group, whether it's through our attorney or our researcher or any one of our staff. To remind everybody that if you have individuals, experts that you would like to testify at an upcoming meeting, to either share the names with us today or to get them to our clerks as soon as possible. Also, you know, in terms of our scheduling, I think that the two co-chairs would like to take a pause after today's meeting for the balance of August to give an opportunity. First of all, there's a lot of vacations going on, and it would be difficult, I think, to get a meaningful group at any particular meeting. And secondly, to let everybody read the information that we've gathered. There have been a lot of reports, and they're all, you know, online. And Angel has emailed everybody with additional reports and links and information. I would just remind everybody that one of the rules that we talked about is that nobody would disseminate information on their own. You would give it to the clerk, and then the two co-chairs would review it and make sure that it was consistent with the focus of the group, and then we would disseminate it. So, again, I would just ask that you not individually email links or information to the different parties. And then in September, we would reconvene. Maybe the first meeting, we would pick up any additional individuals we want to testify and see if perhaps we could get that done in maybe one meeting. And then I envision, I think with Representative Urban, another meeting where we have a meaningful substantive discussion. This will also, in August, give us an opportunity to think through what our impressions are and where we're going, and perhaps to network a little bit and see if there's any consensus or areas that we can agree on. So that's, I think, basically how we envision it. And today's meeting, again, is again, to share thoughts, ask for information, see if we can identify issues that you think are relevant and important, and the clerks will take notes, and then, you know, we can disseminate what the group's identified issues are, which hopefully will help us begin to focus toward a conclusion at some point in time. So, being chair, I'm going to take the prerogative for a moment and just share with you a couple of thoughts that I had, indicating that... why don't you do your opening remark? My apologies.
That's okay. first of all, I'd like to welcome Kathy Queen. And I would point out to the people that are watching on CTN that Kathy's therapy dog, who is a Newfie, who is approximately 160. Oh, he lost weight. He's 140 pounds, and he was present at Newtown and Sandy Hook. And I happened to be there when he was there with about five children attached to him. So I'm really thrilled that Simon found the time to accompany you to this meeting. So thank you very much for agreeing to serve in this position.
Thank you. Simon says he's delighted to be here.
Perfect. And then for the record, Senator Witkos had asked me last week, and I forgot to include it in questions of the record, so I would at this point see there were some issues about background cadmium and where else do you find cadmium and what was cadmium in specific foods. I think it was Dr. Wiedenhammer mentioned it. And we had this brief discussion about, well, yeah, cadmium's an element and it's on the periodic table, it's next to zinc, la, la, la. But then I thought, perhaps you would like to have that as a question for the record. Okay, good. So please, Angel and Alessandra, if we could have that as a question for the record. And with that, I turn it back to my co-chair.
Thank you. So what I'd like to do is start the roundtable discussion and just share with you some of my own thoughts. With the preface that I'm still very open-minded on this whole topic. I don't come to the task force with a preordained conclusion or point of view. At this point, I'm still trying to understand all the information. So in that context, there are a couple of things that I think would be helpful as a task force for us to understand and discuss at some point. The first issue is the difference between the two identified thresholds of 75 versus 300 parts per million. And the doctor, in his testimony at the last meeting, I specifically asked the question, are there any differences, substantive differences? And if I understood him correct, he said no. He then said you might want to talk to a toxicologist to get more information. So that, to me, is a big issue because I know that's one of the points of contention among various members of the group, what's the proper threshold. And if, in fact, the conclusion was that there was no significant difference, that might help individuals come to a consensus or an understanding. The second issue for me was that in the doctor's testimony, he also was asked what kind of jewelry did he use for his testing. And I think he used the terms inexpensive. He may have used the word junk jewelry because he said he bought it himself, so he wasn't going to spend a lot of money on it. And there were some, as discussion ensued, it was pointed out that much of the children's jewelry has some kind of a coating or film on it that goes over it that helps prevent degradation of the cadmium. And so in my mind, I'm thinking, is there a real difference in the kind of jewelry that we're trying to regulate or look at? If, in fact, a piece of jewelry does have some kind of a covering or coating of something that helps prevent the leaching and breach of the cadmium, would that make a difference when we kind of conclude where we're going? Would jewelry that has that kind of protective coating help give confidence to people in coming up with a threshold versus jewelry that did not? And could those kinds of jewelry even be distinguished? I don't know the answers. Another point in my mind was the difference in terms of soluble and non-soluble, how you convert that so that we understand what the numbers are. Because in a quick look at some of the information that was given to us, some states have a regulation by solubility, some by non-soluble, and then there's a whole slew of states that I think have no regulation whatsoever, which means that either they don't care or they just haven't gotten to the point where we are. So that would be helpful in my analysis of it, if there was some conversion that we could look at. Another point is that I believe that under our existing law, while we have written into the statute the 75 parts per million, it hasn't taken effect yet. In fact, the legislation that created this task force kind of pushed it out till 2016. So right now, Connecticut is operating with no regulation in effect because you can do whatever you want. One of the points I think we all agree on is that there needs to be some regulation because we all recognize, and I think there's unanimity of thought, that there is danger in cadmium and that people can get ill from it, and that's why we're all here, to come up with what's the proper regulation. So I say that because I think it behooves us all to try and come to an agreement so that we do have some regulation, and that whatever we decide, whether it's on one side or the other, it's got to be better than what we're doing now, because now we virtually have nothing. The next point that I wanted to make is, and I'm making it so you can give thought to it, whatever we do, there perhaps could be part of that some kind of a notice requirement that maybe it's on the DCP website or in some other fashion, so that when a parent buys jewelry, whatever, again, the regulations are, they are given some kind of notice or they can educate themselves so that they know what are the potential hazards. And that might help us in deciding the threshold to know that in addition to a number that we're adopting, maybe there's something else that people can turn to become more educated. And lastly, and this is just an impression that I wanted to share, and you may agree or disagree, there's obviously a lot of disagreement and contentiousness about how these things are tested. You know, whether it's 24 hours or something longer, whether you make a cut in the jewelry or cut it in half or take a rhinestone out or take the coating off, there seems to be disagreement. And my question to everybody is, in the end, is that going to matter? Because what can we agree on? We know that cadmium as a chemical can be harmful if ingested in large quantities. I don't think at this point, while it might be an aspiration that sometime in the future, maybe cadmium won't be used at all in jewelry, but at this point I think most of us are thinking we have to come up with a number that makes sense and it's safe to regulate it. Does it really ultimately matter? Because we're going to find examples of terrible things, worst case scenarios, and we'll, I'm sure, find scenarios where somebody swallows it and nothing happens. The question is, we're trying to come up with a standard that makes sense, that's fair, that protects our children, and you can always point to tests that show a worse case and a better case. And in the end, because many of us are not scientists or doctors, will that be the most important point? Or will it be more of a common sense, just understanding that there is a danger and we should do something rather than nothing, and that we can't, we don't have a magic wand. We can't necessarily protect every single person unless we just outlaw the chemical, which I don't think is on anybody's agenda right now. So I know that there will be a lot of questions and inquiry into the testing methods and, you know, what the implications are. And I'm not trying to suggest that isn't important. But in the end, we may never reach agreement on what the right test is or how many hours or whether you make the cut or not make the cut. And we're going to have to make a judgment as to what we think under the information we have is best. And when you make those kinds of judgments, I don't think you can cover every single situation. You do the one that I think is that makes sense and that can cover most of the typical situations. So I just want to get things started. I just wanted to share my thoughts and observations. And again, you may say we don't agree with that and that's a short-sighted view, but I just ask that you give it some thought as we go forward, and maybe that helps us narrow the differences. And I will turn it over to my co-chair.
Thank you. And you know, this your observations have certainly brought up issues that I can address. And one of them I'm going to address immediately is that, as I've said from the beginning, this is a very complex subject. So when you're saying that Dr. Wiedenhammer said that it didn't much matter whether it was 75 parts per million or 300 parts per million, what? And I, you know, eventually I'm going to defer to Dr. Ginsburg on this one too. What I believe in studying this issue, he was saying, is that it's how the cadmium sheds from the jewelry that is the issue of concern. And you also brought that up when you talked about the film on the jewelry and how that would encase the cadmium so that it would not be bioavailable to the child. So what Dr. Wiedenhammer said and the graphs that he has, and, you know, I know I taught economics, and the minute I put a graph up on the wall, every kid in the room would have a heart attack. And I'd say, no, no, you know, these can inform you. So what the graphs are informing is that when he tested these jewelry for cadmium, that in a 24-hour period, it might not shed. And then all of a sudden at a day and a half, it sheds massively. And that's why the graphs jump all over the place and it looks like the testing is inconsistent. What he said is, no, what the issue is the alloy that the cadmium happens to be combined with and how that then responds to the stomach acid test or the test where there's wear and tear on the jewelry. So yet again, I just emphasize that it's a complex subject. It's not a linear argument at all. So then going back to, can there be a film on jewelry that will prevent that cadmium from becoming bioavailable? I'm not a chemist. I'm not a toxicologist. But from what I have observed, no, there is not a film that once the child bites on the jewelry, runs it over with a bicycle six or seven times, wraps it, you know, around who knows what, and then pulls on it and then puts it on again. I don't know that there's a film that stops that jewelry from compromising the surface. The ASTM standard does not test jewelry that has been exposed to wear and tear. I would want to know why they didn't test jewelry when it was exposed to wear and tear. When I talk to any child's parent and they will tell you, of course. And I, you know, I present to fourth grade classes, and if you ask a child, you know, what does your sister do when she has a little piece of jewelry? Well, if she had my little piece of jewelry, the first thing she's going to do is put it in her mouth. It's what kids do. That's one, how they, as they grow, that's how they explore things, the mouth. So my big question, one of my big questions would be, why don't we test and for wear and tear on jewelry? The second is what I refer to is the 24-hour acidity test. Mm-hmm. Once that charm, and, you know, so they'll say that my little charm here would be inappropriate for a three-year-old. It's too small. It can be swallowed. That doesn't mean that some grandma's not going to put this on a child and they're not going to swallow it. And when it is a size that they say is appropriate, a kid can still swallow it. So I would want to know that we were sure that the test that we were using would indicate that after that we don't have a spike, which is what Dr. Wiedenheimer's tests show, that there can be a spike after 24 hours. And each child is different. And I think it was Senator Witkos that observed, what was the child eating? If the child's stomach was full, does that have a difference on how long it stays in the system? Particularly, what did they have in their stomach? Were they just drinking, you know, water and juice, in which case would it be flushed very rapidly? We don't know, because if you ask pediatricians, they will tell you that it can be 24 hours to 3 days that the object takes to get expelled from the system. So my second question would be, why 24 hours? Why aren't we looking at what pediatricians might tell us so that we are sure? And I would remind this panel that we're talking about the seventh most toxic substance, ahead of arsenic. It's not, you know, it's not a la-la, here we have something that we don't really need to focus on. It's a heavy metal that is toxic. So I would want to know that we are taking every safety precaution with our children. My other question, which was has already been a question for the record, is at what level do we absolutely have to have cadmium? We've tested jewelry at 40 parts per million, so clearly you can make a piece of jewelry with 40 parts per million. At what point does it fail? And that question we have put out as a question for the record, because why do we have to have 300 parts per million? Or why do we have to have 600 parts per million? At what point do we need it? I know it melts at a lower point. I know it's shinier. It makes the jewelry shiny. And the melting point is lower than, say, zinc, when zinc can be a substitute for cadmium. Zinc's more expensive. So I want to know, you know, at what point do we absolutely have to have the cadmium in the jewelry? And I know that there's a level of cadmium in fine jewelry, but my understanding that's in the soldering material. So maybe we could find out exactly how much they need in that soldering material in order to make the gold jewelry, and maybe that's a reasonable level. That would just be something I'd throw out there. Representative Barham observed that right now we have no standard in Connecticut, and that is in fact true. There is voluntary standards that the Consumer Protection feds have put out there, which is basically looking at the ASTM standard. But I would offer that when we had the scare in 2010 and there were charms that were tested at 90% cadmium, that the market responded. And that's in essence how a market is supposed to work. So people were outraged, and when teaching this, it's called consumer sovereignty and dollar votes. If the consumer is not buying the product, then the message gets back to the market, do not make this product. That's a dollar vote. And Walmart responded, and some of our other bigger chains responded. So the market right now is sending the message that, heads up, cadmium is an issue. We better be prepared to do something about regulating it specifically. And in the interim, I love the education idea, because that fits right into the market model of the consumer being sovereign and saying, I'm not buying this, and then the market responds and says, okay, we're not making it. I guess my last two points come from Washington State, where I have been in contact with one of their terrific toxic policy coordinators for the State Department of Ecology. Over the last 2 years, we have talked and exchanged emails. And one of the things that she pointed out, and it was pointed out in the testimony, that if we take the ASTM standard, then at 300 parts per million, if we have a test that's over 300 parts per million, then we have to do the migration test. And it was pointed out that that migration test is expensive. So knowing that we are in a constrained economy with a constrained budget, my question was, who pays? Does the state pay for this expensive testing? Does the manufacturer pay for this expensive testing? And I happened to be able to talk to Grant Nelson, who is the True North Public Affairs. He handled the business side of this in Washington State. And I said, you know, who are you guys recommending handle it if it's migration testing has to be done? And he said, well, that's not a problem. What we suggest is that we put a tax on hazardous substances. So you would tax the hazardous substance cadmium. That tax would go to a dedicated fund. The dedicated fund is named the Model Toxics Control Account, and that dedicated fund would be used to test the cadmium. I'm not running on that. I can tell you that right now. Taxing toxic substances and making a Model Toxics Control Account, I'm thinking that's going to be an issue. And I would then say, what is the other way that if we were put in this position of having to test when it was over at 300 parts per million, who would be the person, agency, public health? Oh, Gary's just said no. Yeah.
We do have wet chemists, and we have a very capable laboratory, which does need funding for whatever it does. And this kind of digestive acid extraction is a bit more of a workup than we would normally do when doing metal analyses. So, yeah, they could gear up and do it. They would need funding.
Yeah, that was my suspicion, that you would need funding, and I'm glad to get that out there. So, and I know that Alessandra's taking notes, and I totally trust her to get all the things that I've said. But, you know, in a nutshell, I am concerned about the 24 hours. I'm concerned about the wear and tear and the no testing of how that cadmium is shed. I'm concerned about who pays for the migration test once that, if we go that route. And I am not as concerned about immediately getting a standard because the market is at this point in time responding. I am concerned about getting it right. And the reason I'm concerned about getting it right is because it's about children. And cadmium causes kidney damage. It leaches calcium from the bones. It's a carcinogen, and it causes developmental delays. I don't think that it is appropriate for us to rush when we're talking about those kinds of negative impacts on a child's body. So I'm happy to spend a lot of time studying this issue and getting it right. And with that, I turn it back to my co-chair.
Thank you. If I can, I just want to ask one quick question, my co-chair, because you obviously have studied this for a few years. When you're talking about doing a migration test, if it's over 300 parts per million, let's just say hypothetically that we adopted a standard, and that standard was either 300 parts per million or something less. Then, am I correct that there is no issue about doing a migration test? And I don't think, at least I haven't heard anyone around the table suggest a standard that's over 300 parts per million. So I'm just asking a question. If in that hypothetical, whatever the standard was, if it was not over 300 parts per million, why is the migration test an issue? If you can explain that to me.
I'm going to defer to Dr. Ginsberg.
Yeah, the way the ASTM method is written is that the first line of testing is to see the content. So it's sort of like a content initial screen. It's not a content standard. A content standard, I think, is what you're thinking we would have, which is you do an XRF or some complete test of it, find out what it is, and if it's above 300, bright line test, you're done. No, but what ASTM says is that if you're above 300, then you do the migration testing to see what's bioaccessible. And that is either these other numbers, 200 micrograms per 24 hours or 18 micrograms per saliva 6-hour test. If it fails those tests, then it really fails, and then you pull it.
Another I understand that, but once again, let's just pretend we had a 300 parts per million standard. You test it. And if it fails, doesn't that disqualify the piece of jewelry, period, and there's no reason to do any other tests? It's being pulled from the market.
That's the way the law was written as is. That 75, that's the way current legislation is. The way ASTM standard, it's a voluntary standard, the way it's written is that's just the beginning of the second round of testing.
If I can clarify, because I know that it's a difficult subject, Dr. Ginsburg, you referred to the XRF test, which gives us the number. How expensive is that test? And in choosing 75 parts per million with that test, were we saying at that level we're satisfied with that initial test, that we're okay. Whereas if we only use that test on a 300 parts per million, we might not be, or if you can explain that.
Well, I think the XRF test is a good initial screen, and usually the jewelry is not going to be borderline. I mean, many pieces of jewelry that are problematical are clearly over 300, so whatever noise or uncertainty there is in the XRF is probably, if it's DCP or whatever agency is going out with an XRF, is probably not going to be running into a lot of concerns about getting it wrong using the XRF with a number like 75 or 300, because usually where it's problematical, it's very different than 300. Where it's borderline, they might want to then send it off to a lab to do the more exact digestive test. That's still not this migration test. It's just a digestive test. Yeah. Now, regarding whether it's 75 or 300 or some number in between or above or below, I think that in my mind is a secondary importance, sort of like what Dr. Weidenheimer was saying, that there are other approaches to get us there, to whether the number 75 or 300 is basically, in my mind, what's the maximum amount of extraction that's been found in the various testing that's been done in Montreal, that's been done in Ohio, that's been done by CPSC. I think we need to compile all the data and see what's the most amount of extraction you can get from reasonably aggressive testing in acid, and then say whatever that fraction is, if we're concerned about 200 micrograms, well, it's a simple mathematical relationship. Maybe 300 is fine. I haven't done the equation. But in my mind, doing extraction testing then to see how much is migrating gets us into a whole other area of uncertainty and muddiness that I don't know that we want to be getting involved with each piece of jewelry. And while I do have the microphone, let me just say that I did a little bit more internet searching, and I found that Health Canada has a draft standard that was drafted in 2011, which is very interesting, and we may want to take a close look at it. It's only about 10 pages long. And they came up with a number of 130, and they have a product safety lab which did a bunch of testing in 2009, and they based their 2011 draft standard on this. And they basically said that it's too variable. We're not going to do they called it migration testing. We're not going to do migration testing. We're just going to go with what they call a content standard of 130 and leave it at that. So it's a draft, and I looked to see if they ever finalized it or what the status of it is, and I didn't talk to anyone in Health Canada to verify. But if you look at their seizures, they're basing it upon, in 2013, 2014 news reports, they're basing it on a content standard of 130.
That would be parts per million?
Yeah.
Thank you.
May I comment on that?
Actually, what I was hoping to do is spread out to the rest of the group, but since you have the mic, why don't we finish with you? Do you want to share any other thoughts with the group, and then we're going to bounce on this side, we'll go back.
Yeah, just that my general observation is that the most important issue facing us is whether we allow the introduction of migration testing into our decision-making process. If we do, then we could theoretically entertain the possibility of having very high content cadmium out there in the marketplace. And based upon some of the testing that Dr. Weidenheimer showed, unless you're really careful about how you test it, you're really running the risk of allowing really high content cadmium to start leaching into children's GI system. So I would be, at this point, from what I've seen, much more comfortable with a product, a content standard rather than a migration test. And after we agree, in my mind, after we agree about that, then we could talk about the exact number.
So if I can just summarize what I heard, while you've explained, I think, very well the difference between the content and the migration standard, you're saying that it, regardless of what the content is, that the migration testing tells you more information that may be more relevant, but it gets complicated and it's costly, and the simpler thing to do is come up with a simple content standard, whatever that may be, and then that ends the issue, and you don't have to go to the migration testing.
Yeah. For example, there's a 2014 paper by the Montreal group which looked at four different migration test methods, and they ended up saying it still needs more research.
Thank you. I'm going to bounce on this side, and Senator Witkos, would you like to share your thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I think it would be helpful, at least from my perspective as a layperson who's learning a lot while serving on this task force, is if we had somebody that had some experience and expertise in basically a gastrointestinal specialist to talk about what happens with products in the stomach, how long they basically stay there, how long, what happens with, what happens to be, whether it's a metal object or food process, so how they interact with each other, how long does it stay, moves to the lower intestine, what happens then. I think I get a better understanding as to some of the 24-hour acidic tests that we talked about. Is that a true replica of what generally happens in the stomach? Is there a big difference between an adult and a child? Because according to my notes, testing doesn't differentiate between the two. It's the same. So I'd like to hear some more information from that field of expertise. I guess one of the questions I'd like to ask Dr. Ginsberg is, when you said we have to gear up for a test, how long does a test take to run if we were to take a product? I mean, I don't think anybody disputes the fact that a non-worn or distressed item is probably safe. And I think the question was, we just didn't test, in my mind, we didn't test something that was distressed or worn. And I know Representative Urban said, well, why don't we? But how long does it take to do a test of that type of an object, and what is the cost would somebody be looking at for that?
Yeah, I talked to the CPSC person who did a lot of the testing, their toxicologist, Christine, I don't have her name. Yeah, I got her on the phone the other day. But anyway, the test runs between $50 and $200 per sample. You don't want to do just one. Let's say there's 10 samples on the shelf. You probably, because, and she agreed to that, you wouldn't just take one off the shelf. You'd want to do duplicate or triplicates. So if, say, something triggered our content issue, then you would probably have to do it, say, in triplicate. And so that's $50 to $200 per test times three to get remove that one product off the to make a decision about that one product. The test itself, it's the way ASTM runs it, it's a 24-hour test. The way some other labs run it, you can run it out to 144 hours. So I would say within 2 weeks, you'd probably have the result back, depending upon, you know, how efficient the lab is in dotting the I's and crossing the T's and writing a report and getting it back to the regulatory authority. But probably within 2 weeks, I would say you can get a result back. XRF, obviously, is very fast. Sure. Yeah, it's real time.
That, I guess, for, to me, begs the question as to why we don't request a testing of a sampling of what was non-distressed and distressed an item from either the toy industry or the jewelry industry to say, compare the two. I think that scientific results would really go a long way to helping me understand what that is. So those are my two issues that I'd like to see us explore a little bit further. Just sit back and listen to the rest of the debate. Thank you.
For the record, so that we know, it is Chris Hatwood, and she's at the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and she's a PhD toxicologist.
Okay, I'm going to bounce back to this side, and Rick Maloney from the Department of Consumer Protection, Public Health.
That'd be the Department of Consumer Protection. Thank you, Chairman. Thank you. You know, one question that I had for the record that perhaps we could discuss, and I would look to the toy industry to kind of answer this for us. You know, how many of these items are in the chain of commerce currently? You know, we really have no sample of what the industry looks like, and I'm not sure whether you have done any sampling and you know where we are or where we're not. Thank you.
Can get that answer. Next, Representative Dan Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there's a couple things going around in my head as well. I'm really trying to understand when we talk about the testing, and I know this came up with the good chairwoman. Are we looking at testing that's going to be done by the regulatory agency in Connecticut as a sampling procedure, or aren't manufacturers doing some sort of testing of their products before they put them in the market that they share with the regulatory authority? Because, you know, we're looking at apples and oranges in the sense of us creating an empire of testing and going out and testing all these things and, you know, having exorbitant cost versus having the manufacturers doing this as part of their regular business. So I want to have that answered at some point, because it seems to me that if a manufacturer is supposed to meet ASTM standards, that they're doing that, and there has to be a way to prove that they're doing that. So that's the first part. So the other thing I want to make sure that we keep in mind is I'd like to learn a little more about the ASTM standards and how they came up with this again, because it seems to me like they put, again, we only listened to two experts so far. And one he was talking about the ASTM standards, and it seems like they put a lot of thought into this. You know, exactly how long it takes to get through a child's stomach versus a child's system. And those are two different things. We keep throwing around different days, and it's 6 hours for a stomach, or it's 5 days all the way through. What does that mean? And how do they consider that? Because it seems to me they put a lot of thought into it. So I might want to know more, because we're dealing with standards that affect, you know, the whole country. And I think we just want to make sure, before we come up with our own, that we do all our own homework and come with our own standards, that we've adequately explored what they've done. And that's still, you know, running around in my head on that. And the other one, I mean, this is the only, Dr. Wiedenheimer, I believe, is the only trial I've seen, or the only study I've seen, looking at the distressed jewelry. I'd like to see more, because I think he makes a very, very good point about, you know, if a jewelry is damaged or cut or whatever, how that affects the standard, I don't know. And I think that's something that we need to look at even further. So.
Thank you, Representative. And I would, as far as the manufacturer testing, I'm not sure what's going on, but I do know that TSCA, the Toxic Substances and Control Act, has been a bone of contention, because there is not certainty that if you have the manufacturer test and it's not verified by a government entity, that is in fact the manufacturing testing accurate. Bye. It was so nice to talk to you. So anyway, just to get that on the record, we have, you know, there is a lot of controversy over TSCA. It was passed in the 70s. It hasn't been updated. It's been a political football in D.C. And one of the reasons is because of that testing issue. Do we verify? Who was it that said trust but verify? Was that President Reagan? Anyway, you know, what is the issue on that particular question?
Okay. Next we'll go to Ann Hewlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of questions. One, kind of building off what Senator Witkos said about other experts and medical professionals. I was also wondering, are there other concerns for exposure from cadmium in children's jewelry? Is it just through swallowing an item, or is there also dermal, you know, skin absorption or other things like that? So I kind of want to know a little bit more about that. And also a separate question, and I think we've asked it already, but I just wanted to make sure. Are there other standards, like in the EU? Has this already been addressed in other countries, and we can adopt and learn from their process of what they went through? I don't know if that's the case, so I thought that might be helpful to this group's discussion. Okay.
They have a two-hour migration standard, which has been pretty much critiqued by some recent papers. But they have the EU 71 standard for migration testing. It's only a two-hour migration test, so it's been widely I'm not going to say criticized, but people have other thoughts about that.
Great point, and I got that down. Next, we'll go to Tim Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My thoughts are echo a lot of what Representative Carter said. I would just thought that I think it's always helpful if we could almost walk through the process. I mean, we have a manufacturer of toys in Connecticut. Let's get a manufacturer in here and talk to us, if we can, about what is the process that they go through now? What are the standards that they have to meet already? What is the testing requirements? Who comes in and tests, who, you know, verify the test requirements? All this stuff before it hits the market. Because, you know, there's very valid and important comments made about the safety to children. I was appointed on this committee to represent the jewelry industry, and, you know, that's where our concern is. How is this going to impact us as we direct with direct line to in the market to have to sell our stuff and compete in a highly competitive marketplace and to deal with customers? So I think it would be helpful to everybody if we understood, you know, what is the process that we're going through now. And then not only that, if the task force should decide to change the standard, what's the impact on that going to mean for the small retailer that has to sell the stuff? What are the economic impacts of that? If there's a way that we can, you know, have that conversation or measure that in some way, those are some thoughts that I had.
A couple of quick reactions or questions. One would be, if there's a feeling that we need a toy manufacturer to address the committee to discuss what the process is, it's going to be somebody's responsibility representing them to tell us who we should invite, unless somebody who's on the task force has the ability to do that. We should know that too, so we can schedule a time for them to address the committee. And the same thing with the impact to the realtors, the retailers. If I don't know if you're looking for an economist or somebody from the industry, but we need a name of somebody who can address the committee. And that's every committee meeting I try and say that. If you have names of people, please give them to us, because at some point we will say, okay, you know, we've done a lot. Let's start seeing if we can make a decision. We're cutting off the testimony. So during this month, I would recommend to everybody, if there's a topic you want to hear about, we'll try and find the expert if you don't know who it is. But if you have ideas, please let us know.
That's my homework assignment, I guess.
Next, we're going to jump over to Kathy.
I'm not sure I've been sitting here long enough yet to even formulate questions. but I'm here representing the interests of children. And I remember I started in early childhood education back in the early 1900s. and back before lead paint was banned, for example. And there was lead in everything. And my understanding from what I've been able to read here is that cadmium is sort of the new lead showing up in things. But I remember the developmental delays that I saw in some very young children who had exposure to lead back in the early 70s, for example. And if we can manage to stop that from happening to one more kid, whatever we have to do, let's please do it. And I do understand the economics of the whole process and stuff. But as I understand it, cadmium is, it's been known to be toxic for a very long time. And there's been lots of tests out there, at least since the early 80s, that set standards for this kind of thing. And it seems to me that it would be nice if we could agree on something that would prevent that kind of damage from happening to any other children. So I'm here to learn, and hopefully I'll be polite and just be very quiet and learn. Thank you.
Well, thank you for those comments, and always be polite, but don't necessarily be quiet. Okay, we're going to go over to Tony DeGeorge.
I just had a couple of comments. I know we've been going back and forth, and I hear a lot about that cadmium was, you know, the new lead. And in all reality, I can't maybe speak for everyone, but from our side at FAF, and I know I have a lot of friends in the industry, cadmium was not a replacement for lead. Zinc was. What was out there was, you know, it was already in the industry at high levels because it wasn't, there was no, you know, mandatory levels or things set for cadmium at that time. We made great strides since then. What happened with maybe some additional maybe pieces that had cadmium in them, that zinc is very hard to bring to a melting point. So what we found was, you know, spinning zinc into a rubber mold, it wouldn't spread out enough and it'd blow out the molds. So what they were doing was adding small amounts of cadmium to the zinc so it would spread. That's in the past. Coming up to date now, we use steel molds. So the steel molds are able to take a high heat, so when they're, you know, melting down the zinc, it's okay. From my standpoint, I, you know, look at to want to listen to all testimony, and I think, you know, a scientific-based standard is what we need. I was actually on the ASTM board, and we did put a lot of thought and effort into everything we did. We had a lot of testing and backup with that. CPSC was involved, a lot of testing that came out of it. I think it's a really good standard, something we should think about and we should look at from all ends.
Thank you.
One more thing.
That's helpful, by the way, that you were on the board, and maybe when we come back to that discussion, if there's insight you can offer us, because there were a number of questions about how the board made these decisions. You might have some insight.
And there was one more thing. I know there's a question out there on testing. Really, right now, at this point, it's on our responsibility to make sure everything complies. So, and we bring it back as far as to the vendor base. So the vendor would test their raw materials and finished goods with a third-party lab. We then step in as well and pull from that production run, and we test at a third-party lab. And the other thing I want everyone to remember is we do it down to component level. We don't take the item and test the item in an entirety. It's broken down into components, and that's the same thing as the way it's tested for lead. So I'm not sure how the testing was done by the doctor, if it was in whole, which is a question I do have. Is it the whole piece that was tested, or is it broken down into components? So I think that's something that we should bring up as well. And in addition to that test that we perform on our own, there's also testing that we have to do for our customers out of their third-party lab. So it's tested multiple times throughout the manufacturing process to ensure that what makes it to the retail stores is, you know, compliant to all the regulatory regulations.
Can I just ask you for clarification? When you say it's tested by component part, can you just give me an example so I understand what you mean?
So if you have a necklace and there's a lobster claw, jump ring, chain, pendant, each one of those individual components is tested individually, not as a whole. So even a lobster claw broken down into three parts, not as an individual piece, because you have the lobster claw itself, the clasp, and the spring on the inside. So each one of those components is broken down and tested individually. The chain would be tested, the jump ring individually, the charm. Any paint surface coating separated. So if there's three colorways, say red, white, blue, each colorway is broken down and tested individually.
So if a manufacturer, let's say, is making thousands of bracelets, let's say, but you're saying the component parts of the bracelet are tested, how many bracelets of the volume are tested? I mean, if you have 1,000 bracelets in a big box that's being shipped to Walmarts, we'll say, are every single bracelet tested? Or they
it's impossible to test by wet chemistry. And a lot is done by XRF screening at the vendor's facility. It's good to test on the raw material itself. So if you get the chain in raw, you can screen XRF and be pretty accurate that way. What we do at the end of the day is when the items are made, pieces off the original production run are pulled. Usually up to about 24 pieces will be pulled and sent to a lab for one individual test. So if we're doing that three or four times, then those pieces go three or four times
so
separately.
So if a piece fails and it's part of a big shipment, then is a hold put on the whole shipment?
Absolutely. Holds put on the entire shipment, but it depends on what failed. So say the lobster claw failed. That would be what would be isolated and removed from the item. We'd have to resource new lobster claw from a different source to have that go through all its testing protocols as well, and then have the whole item retested again before it can be put back onto an okay to ship.
Sure, go ahead.
I was really interested in your observations about zinc versus cadmium. So zinc had, and I had said initially that cadmium has a low melting point and it's shiny. Zinc has a high melting point, and you said that was a problem because of the mold. And then now you have, now they're metal molds, so you can subject it to a higher temperature. So my question is, why didn't we, I suspect that zinc is more expensive on the world market than cadmium, because cadmium is often something that countries or areas want to get rid of, they don't want to keep. So if zinc worked, why did we switch to cadmium?
I don't recall. We didn't switch to cadmium. We, as a company...
So you're telling me that, you're saying the cadmium's always been there. It wasn't when lead was regulated that then the level of cadmium did not increase in jewelry?
I don't believe so.
What did they substitute lead for?
You're not giving me...
We didn't substitute lead with anything. Cadmium was already in the market. There was no regulatory regulations at the time for cadmium. So a lot of what happened in the beginning when there was testing done, it was already in the market as there was no regulatory regulations. So that's why you saw a lot of high levels of cadmium in the industry. There was no standard at the time. So when it became public, that's when it started to pick up speed, and everyone started to address it. So if you was to go out in the market now, I would pretty much say you're not going to see the levels of cadmium at the levels they were back then. I can say as a company, I had started with FAF in 2007 and 2008. There was no standard, but I implemented our own standard, which we follow the heavy metals, the EN271. For something for a soluble limit. So we put some restrictions on it, even when there were no limits at the time. So then I think it became, a big subject because lead was something, everyone started to address it. And yes, at the time you would go out into the market and find these high levels of cadmium. But I really don't think at this time you would find things like that. I think the industry as a whole did a very, very good job at trying to, reduce those numbers and come up with different ideas and ways to reduce those high levels. And zinc was one. And we found other ways because it was new to us to try and use zinc in a substitute for white metal because of the high melting point. And we learned from that. Like, you know, it's still at the time when there was a little bit of cadmium added, there still was no standards. The only standards we had was the one that I implemented was the EN71, which was, I think, 75 parts per million soluble at the time. And then as we progressed, we became better at it. So we have for a lot of casted pieces, we can use zinc.
Thank you for that clarification. And if you could just clarify one other thing. When we did regulate lead after that child died, my understanding, or at least looking in the world market and what happened with cadmium at that point in the world market, now I'm talking as an economist, the price of cadmium was very low. Was it used? What did they substitute for lead at that point in time? Not cadmium, is what you're saying. I'm talking China.
Yes, our vendors are in China. We used zinc.
So we meaning you.
My company and our suppliers,
gotcha.
Which was about 30 of them at the time, we went to zinc. And I know I do have other friends in the industry who went the same way. Like I said, I can't speak for the entire industry as a whole. I can speak for a portion of it. And I think for the most part, I think everybody was looking for child safety. You know, our industry is big on safety, adult and children. We're all looking as though, yes, we talk about profit, but the number one thing in our industry for both adult and children is safety.
Thank you. You know, I have an off-the-subject question that you might be able to ask me to answer. You know the rabies tags that we put on the dogs? Do you know what they're made out of, or do you wouldn't?
I don't know.
All right, that's a question for the record. Only, no, it's just that now we have Simon sitting here, and I'm worried now about Simon. So maybe I can find that out. Senator Erb, back to
thanks. I just wanted to ask you a question. When you said that it was in 2008, 2007, it seemed like the industry shifted, changing the product, and you realized one may have been more harmful. Did anything go out to the DPUC or any of the other agencies that regulate that in the States to say, hey, you may want to reach out to your consumers to pull this off the shelf? Because we've changed our products because we've recognized the fact on our own voluntarily without a standard, but there's still stuff in the marketplace you may not, it could be harmful to children, so, you know, use caution or
did
whatever.
Did
anybody do any type of PR? Or
we didn't do any of that. At the time, like I was mentioning, there really was no standard for cadmium. I took it and our company as a whole wanted to veer away from cadmium and any other chemical for that matter that we can to try and be ahead of the curves if there's something that does come up.
But was there, so there was no warning even though you recognized that there was an issue and that there you voluntarily made a move to correct that issue. We didn't go any further to say there's stuff out there.
Honestly, I can't say that we identified it as an issue. It was something from our vantage point as a company and for me running the department, I didn't feel that we needed to use cadmium in our product.
Okay.
I didn't do a testing out through the market to see what was out there or what the levels were. Maybe that's something I could have done. I didn't realize that it was a big issue. We just took it upon ourselves as I was rewriting manuals and things that I wanted that as a part of what our company presented.
My last question was, out of the 30 or so companies that you do business with, your vendors, what percentage of the market share in the U.S. Do you say that you have, your company?
What percentage?
I don't know if there's a ton of children's jewelry manufacturers, or is it?
I can say we are a big supplier to a lot of, you know, the major retailers out there. As far as percentage-wise, I'm not sure.
Are we talking over 25? Are we 50? I mean, just a ballpark is what I'm looking for.
I don't think so. I don't think that high. But, I think it's maybe under 20.
Okay.
And that's just an estimate. I'm not really sure. But, like I said, we are big suppliers to a lot of the major retail chains and in the big box stores.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Gary?
So, is your testing, pre-market testing of the jewelry done overseas?
Yes.
By a third-party laboratory?
Credited lab.
In China?
Yes.
Okay. And what, if you're doing an XRF on the jewelry, what is the number you're looking for? What fails on an XRF?
For the third-party testing, XRF is not used.
No, I don't mean that. I mean when you're screening.
Would you do a pre-screen?
Yeah. What number do you use?
For cadmium?
Uh-huh.
75.
You know, it might be useful, and I'm switching over here, unless you wanted that Dr. Ginsberg explains what the XRF test is, because we're throwing XRF around, and I'm not sure if people actually know what that means.
XRF is X-ray fluorescence. It's like a magic wand. I mean, you just have to hold it up to a surface. Let's say if this was a lead impregnated or a painted surface, it would give you a reading if it's set for lead, or it could be set for cadmium, and there's a jewelry piece in my hand, and it will give you the readout for how much cadmium is in that piece of jewelry. So it's non-invasive, non-destructive, very rapid, real-time screen.
I'd like to say one point to that, though. It is a good tool, but in my use and experience with it, it's good down at the raw material level. With costume jewelry, there's a lot of mixtures of different components, surface coatings, plating that's there that it's, like you say, it's XRF. It's a screen through, it's an X-ray. It can only see so far.
So then is it possible that it tends to underestimate because of all the other things in the way?
I wouldn't say underestimate. It can go either way. I've used it, and it could be under, or it could be give false readings that are very high. We've had XRF failures, and we've actually set up a wet chemistry, and they were perfectly fine. So I think on the raw material side, I think it's very good to use. So if you had a raw spool of chain or raw, you know, jump rings or things of that nature, or even like epoxy. And red epoxy, and you wanted to screen that, I think it's really good, but I think the wet chemistry is definitely the way.
I'm pretty sure it was the CPSC data that looked at a variety of different pieces of jewelry and had good correlation between the XRF and the wet chemistry. I mean, it wasn't perfect, and they certainly say use the wet chemistry for confirmation, but it looked to my naked eye that it was a pretty good quick screen. And that's what CPSC is using at the ports. They're using XRF.
And I'm saying
for cadmium and jewelry.
In our experience, we don't. I'd rather go wet chemistry. And we have solid results there. Hard numbers, they're very accurate. That's just how we move forward.
You bring up another topic in your answer that I'm curious about. You were asked about. If this is tested overseas in China or wherever the jewelry is coming from. In Connecticut, do we have any numbers on how much of this jewelry, children's jewelry, is made overseas versus how much is made in the United States or in Connecticut specific?
Numbers for the industry itself or for what we supply?
Oh, for instance, of children's jewelry sold in Connecticut is like 20%, 25%. Manufactured and made right here in Connecticut with 0%.
That I don't have that figures. I'm not sure what's manufactured in Connecticut itself.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, we just did a survey in our industry, and it was 90 to 95% came from China.
From China, yes. And so when we purchase jewelry from China or any other country, if I heard you correctly, you as the distributor, retailer, require a third-party lab to independently verify the results of the tests that are being taken over there?
Yes.
And then you do your own tests when it comes over, your random.
We're doing all, no, we used to work that way to where product would come in. It was kind of inefficient that way. What I have is a team of China staff that's out there. We have a facility out there. We have a QC team. They'll pull samples directly from the supplier's production run and send it to a third-party lab that we work with to verify what the vendor has already done.
So you're picking the lab, not the manufacturer in China?
The manufacturer, no. They use a separate lab.
Yes.
Sometimes they have in-house wet chemistry as well. And then we have a lab that we work with to verify those testings. And then we also have to send off to the customer's third-party lab on top of that testing.
And all of that takes place in China?
Yes.
Okay. And then when it is shipped to Connecticut, is there additional testing that's done?
There's no additional testing at that point.
Sure.
China and lands in the U.S. at the ports, is what Dr. Ginsberg was saying. Yes. It's tested again there. Right.
A small random small sample.
Right. But so there's plenty of testing level. Now those levels that are when it's tested in China, what are the levels they're testing for? Are they the same the standards here?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're all what the regulatory standards are for the U.S. Absolutely, yes. So whatever the federal limits are, that's what we're testing.
And
we don't have federal limits.
Not for cadmium.
Right. So what are they testing for cadmium?
Right now?
Yeah.
We're trying to meet 75.
And my
but again, that's not something that can always be attainable. And then if something is 76, we've got to destroy it.
You know, that would be...
I was just going to ask, my last question is, if you're adhering to 75 parts per million, is that soluble or non-soluble, and how does that compare to the threshold in the Connecticut statute that would take effect of 75? Are we talking about the same 75?
We're talking about the same 75, but it also goes by customer, because not everybody is 75. There are some who are at 300, there are different levels, which makes it very difficult for us as manufacturer suppliers to try and go to different levels, because there are some things that we can do at a higher level that we can't do at 75. There's cadmium in certain colors of paints, like say a red and an orange. There's higher cadmium levels in glass, to where we can't use glass for specific customers because the cadmium levels are just, you know, higher than 75. So that's why, you know, we try to look. We'd love to have something that's a national standard, and that way we can try to meet one standard for everybody instead of having this one has 75 soluble, this has 75 total, this one's 300. It makes it very difficult to supply, because then at the end of the day, the customer asks, well, why can't I get this?
So when you implement, and I understand you're making an individual decision for your trade, 75, do you have other levels that you're implementing for glass or colored jewelry that are higher? Are there multiple thresholds that you're using for different types of products?
We're going by what the customer requirement is. What surface coating versus substrate. And then whatever that level would be is what we need to obtain. That's why I'm looking for like more something like the national standard, where it's one standard for everyone.
Is there something that you could provide with co-chair's agreement that you could provide the committee that would share with us these different standards and how they apply, even though they may be voluntary implemented by the industry? It would be helpful to me just to understand and see what you're doing now without any regulation. Can you
sure
compare that?
Okay.
Would that be okay with
you? With the caveat that you're asking what he's doing. That's not what the industry is doing. That's what he's doing in his part of the industry. So my question would be, I'd be interested in what you're doing, but I also want to know what the entire industry is doing with the import of children's jewelry from China. It's a significant number. And so I'd want to know not just what your voluntary standards are, but what other corporations that are importing jewelry are doing. So that would be, I mean, I'm happy to have what he's doing, but then my question is immediately going to be, what is everybody else doing? But I also have
I can try, yeah. I can see what I can come up with.
I also have, you know, with the knowledge that you've exhibited, that goes back to my other question. And it seems when you're saying there are different cadmium levels for different products, depending upon what you're trying to achieve.
Well, different customers.
Right, customers, for what they want. You know, exactly. I mean, that's how the market works. But my question has been consistently, what is the necessary level of cadmium before the product fails? So I'm assuming that answer is not a static answer. It's a dynamic answer depending upon what the customer is asking for. So it might be that they want something that requires a higher level of cadmium, so that it wouldn't be able to achieve that if the regulatory level was below what allowed you to do what the customer was asking for. So if you,
Yeah.
So it makes it difficult, in other words, to say at what point does the product fail, because your rejoinder is going to be what product,
what product?
Exactly which one. Okay, good. Thank you for that clarification. Right.
Yeah, what customer?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because we do have like some customers who do follow
right.
the AS team standard, so I'm okay because, you know, I can use glass or certain different componentries for them, but not others.
That's exactly what I was asking.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to go to Brent Cleveland, and I believe that after he speaks, everyone will have had a first opportunity.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see. I am the chairman of the ASTM committee that developed this standard. At the time that we initiated this work was back in 2010 when all of this was coming about and states were randomly picking levels and information and regulations not based on any scientific information. Just pretty much what's the other guy doing and, well, let's do the same because we want to protect our children. And, of course, we as an industry responded to that because we want to protect children also. So in that whole effort, we had to first decide what the toxicological risk and hazards were, because none of this information was available. So at the time, we took samples, and we took control samples that we made 1% cadmium, which is 10,000 ppm, 5% cadmium, 50,000 ppm, and 10% cadmium, or 100,000 ppm, and we took that control, we had it raw, just as it existed as an alloy. We did a minimal plate that you would find on very inexpensive merchandise, and we did a more expensive plate that you would find on designer goods, perhaps in high-end department stores. What our whole purpose for doing this was to determine the relationship between total content and solubility. You know, how much of the chemical would migrate from this piece, opposed to how much you could quickly test with an XRF gun and come up with a quick reading. What we found, both we and CPSC found, was that there were too many variables with how that cadmium was being mixed to come up with any predictive reliant information. So that's where the CPSC and the committee decided that migration, you know, finding how much of this would actually come off the piece if it were accidentally ingested, was the way to measure the risk. The way to measure the total content is, of course, XRF, assuming that you can get reliable readings. XRF guns have increased and improved dramatically over the last couple of years, even to the point now where the CPSC has certified one XRF gun to test the substrate, you know, the undercoating of a casting, as an XRF reading, which is pretty significant. But I have provided to both the Children's Committee and the General Law Committee the results of our findings, which is in this exponent report. The CPSC report is 86 pages and involves all of the questions that you've been asking. The questions of, what are the toxicological impacts, what's the relationship between total content and migration. And out of all of this information, we came up with what we found to be a safe standard. So that's how we did that. The way that we, again, dealt with the abrasive Dr. Wiedenhammer information was that we used the raw piece. So, of course, there was no coating over it. There was nothing to inhibit the migration of that. And so that is the cleanest way that we could get the reading. Although we did get some variance between sample to sample, we didn't get variations as high as Dr. Wiedenhammer's experience. I think the reason for that is that even we have a limit of 75 parts per million soluble on surface coatings. Surface coatings would be paint. Now, why is that a lower level than we're recommending on everything else? Because your body can digest paint. And so whatever lead or cadmium or any chemical that's in that paint will be liquefied and available for your body to absorb it. We call that bioavailable. So based on that bioavailability, we use that standard. So when we began this committee, we were identifying the scope of what we were going to be talking about as being the accidental ingestion of a component part of a piece of jewelry. And again, I'd like to again stress what Anthony was talking about earlier. When jewelry is tested, every single component part is separated and tested individually. If any one of those parts fails, the entire piece fails. to where you, if you have an opportunity, you can replace that part with compliant merchandise and remanufacture, or it gets scrapped. So we decided when this committee started that we weren't going to talk about a chronic bioaccumulation of cadmium, because that is not the pathway of exposure that would be found in children's jewelry. In fact, actually, as a doctor was testifying by Skype last week, smoke is the number one contributor to of cadmium in humans. So, I mean, something like that, if we're talking about a chronic, we should be looking at the developmental delay and everything can happen from, you know, repeated exposure. So, and again, we're not talking about the fact that cadmium is a carcinogen when it's inhaled. It's not listed as a carcinogen when it's ingested, when it's swallowed. So anyway, getting back to, you know, the scope, the 24-hour test that's in the ASTM standard is not a test to show the bioavailability of cadmium. It's to show the pieces that would be at risk. In other words, if you had a piece that was tested in this heated agitated acid solution for 24 hours and you didn't have a migration of 200 micrograms, then if it was in there for 6 days, you wouldn't have a dangerous level. That's what their findings concluded. And so that's why we have that 24-hour test with that 200 microgram standard. Of course, the standard is lower if it's a plastic piece. And why? Because your body can digest plastic more readily than it can digest metal. So, again, the main problem with Dr. Wiedenhammer's examples were that he didn't use the test that separated component parts. So, therefore, if he did one cadmium exposure test on a piece that had paint, perhaps all the cadmium in that paint would be bioavailable, where the casting would not. And so that's the reason that we have to separate all those component parts. So, again, the presence of a chemical, you would use a total content test. To measure the risk, you would use a migration test. So at any rate, I think that the real question that this group has to analyze is that there are three questions to consider. First, is the 300 ppm screening level safe, or is 75 required? Is migration the appropriate test to measure risk? And do we need a standard at all? And I think that if we could end up reaching a consensus at the end of our meetings on those three items, we're going to have something that is going to be meaningful, helping industry, helping Connecticut business, and helping the harmonization effort. Dr. Ginsberg mentioned Health Canada. I have met with Health Canada, and I'm very familiar with the report that he's referring to. In fact, if you look at that report, those were referring to children 3 and under. They were looking at infant and young children exposure to cadmium as being the highest risk group. And, you know, great progress has been made in completely removing cadmium from things like baby bottles and teething rings and all of those kinds of things, you know, because, of course, that is the highest risk. So at any rate, you know, many of you around this table have also received a letter from Chairman Tenenbaum. And she was the chairman of the CPSC at the time that the CPSC was working with ASTM putting together this standard. She states in that letter that the jewelry on the counters is safe now. She refers to the study of the last CPSC poll where, it was, I believe it was 2.5 years ago, they went out and took 780 pieces of jewelry and went and did testing, both XRF and total content, and found that out of the 780, there were, I believe, two that were not in compliance. They ruled those two as not being children's merchandise. Because, of course, that's a big question. What is children's merchandise? When I was down at ASTM and we were going through this, they were saying, what do you consider to be children's merchandise? If a 12-year-old walks up to an adult counter, sees a strand of imitation pearls, and says, gee, I'd like to buy that, and she reaches into her pocket and pulls out her babysitting money of $20 to buy that strand, is that now a children's item? Well, that was a huge decision to make that would have, of course, ramifications throughout the industry. So what the part of what the standard does is that it clearly establishes and defines what children's jewelry is. Children's jewelry is expressly designed and marketed to children 12 and under.
So this would mean in packaging you would have the picture of a child, or it would have a Barbie marketing influence to it. There would be something there to specifically focus that item for children. Also, whatever is sold in a children's department must be for children. And so the delineation was developed that way. So in addition to the chairman's letter, many of you have also received letters from other legislators and also other retailers, from Walmart to Swarovski to Alex Anani, and a variety have sent in letters to both the Children's Committee and the General Law in support of this standard as being safe. So again, it comes down to the three questions. Is the 300 ppm cadmium screening limit low enough? Oh, I've got to clarify one other thing. We have been referring to that backwards. What the standard says is that migration testing is what's required. If you do a total content XRF and you come up with 300 ppm or less, you don't have to do the migration testing. So it's not as though the CPSC is saying, gee, 300 ppm total content is fine, because actually the test, which you can read about in the report, goes up to 1,200. They also found that to be completely fine. So what they're saying is that the migration is the key indicator of risk, and the screening level was just a way to reduce the cost. And again, if the cheapest way for any but Connecticut person to gain a copy of that test is to ask the manufacturer. Every single children's item that's in the marketplace has an identifying tracking number. And you can go through that tracking number, you can find out the manufacturer, and you can say, hey, give me your third-party testing. So let's deal with third-party testing for a moment. These companies in China that are performing the tests are companies like UL or Bureau Veritas. I mean, they're American companies with an American presence that, rather than have samples shipped from China to here to be tested and then back to China to keep track of the samples, they have a Chinese affiliate. They have a Chinese company that they own. So these are really American facilities over there that are conducting tests. These are third-party, no relationship between the two, independent testing that's taking place. And that's required of all children's items coming into this country. Regarding the inspection of the CPSC at the ports, the CPSC stated that they had 6,800,000 items returned, I believe it was the last calendar year, back to China as being non-compliant. China now has their own standard. Ecuador has adopted the ASTM standard. We're dealing with Health Canada. We're dealing with Washington State. You know, out of all the states in this country, there are only three that don't comply with our standard, and Connecticut being one. And we're trying to do that to get harmonization, reduce the testing cost, convince consumers that this is a safe and worthy standard, and that we've done our homework, and that's where it is. So, two, is migration effective testing of risk? Absolutely. It is the only way to determine the route of exposure and the bioavailability of that chemical. Realize, too, that the standard addresses all known hazards and risks, not just cadmium. In fact, we have a nickel skin test because we have found that some people have an allergy to nickel, and so that we test that nickel test in the standard to allow people to make that decision. It also regulates batteries, magnets, things that can cause surgery, and so it's a comprehensive standard. And so the last question is, do we need to regulate jewelry? We absolutely do, because you've got to keep the bad guys out of the market. And, it's often been said you can't legislate against criminals. Well, because criminals are going to be criminals. But what you can do is set a set of standards that the industry voluntarily complies with. We wish it would be mandatory, but it's not. And actually, you could say that it is mandatory because our standard is law in Rhode Island. And so we're looking forward to furthering that harmonization. So I would be happy to entertain any questions that anyone has.
I have a couple. If I heard you correctly, you're saying that the most important test is the migration test, because that's risk. And that the risk may be different regardless of what the total content is, for a variety of reasons. You could have a lower total content, but for some reason it has a higher risk, and vice versa. But what I'm hearing from prior remarks is that the migration test is more costly, takes a little more time, so that the standards that have been adopted by these various groups tend to focus on the content, saying if it's under a certain content, it's probably okay. I'm trying to understand, is that what your position is? Is that even though the migration test may be the better test, that you yourself, again, your personal view, is that a content test or number would be the appropriate way to go given all these other factors? Or are you advocating against a content test and just going with the migration test?
That's a very good question, and I think it's important to realize that migration testing is the only way to determine risk. And, of course, the risk varies with the material that you're discussing. So as part of the standard, there's a 75 ppm soluble limit on plastics because you can digest plastics more readily than metal. The metal, of course, has a 200 microgram limit and a 24-hour heated agitated test. The plastic was a two-hour test, the EM71. So again, we have broken this down by levels of exposure, pathways of exposure, and content of material to make sure that we are effectively protecting children.
One other thing I have to ask you, when we all got here, there was a handout, and it doesn't have a name on it or anything, but since you started out your remarks saying these are the three things we need to look at, this memo starts out with the three things. So I'm assuming this may have come from you. And if it did, my only concern is that, again, we're trying to control information so that people don't start giving selective things out. So if this was from you, what I was going to suggest is that maybe the chairs have a chance to look this over because I haven't had a chance to read it. We want to make sure that there's not information in here that not everybody has access to or somehow, distorts a larger report, that we should get the larger report for everybody. And I would suggest, in the future that if people have handouts, again, it just come to the chairs. And it would be, helpful to us for you to identify the handout. If it's yours, just put your name on it so we know it's coming from you. If it's from an organization, please identify the organization. But again, we would prefer that it come to the chairs first, and then we will distribute it. And frankly, as we get, further along and we start our debate, I could anticipate it might be helpful for people to put their thoughts in writing and we're sharing it with one another. I'm not sure, we're at that point yet. This was more anticipated for me to be more of a verbal discussion so we can all get a sense of where we're coming from. So with that, caution and request, I would just say, make sure all handouts come to the chairs, identify, if you're giving us something to review, is it yours individually, or is it from an organization or some kind of a test or research project?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for not putting my name on it, but I thought the protocol was to give it to Angel. And this was actually just a written summary of my verbal presentation.
It may have been Angel, our clerk, disseminated this, and again, we're learning. So we will we'll just ask again if anything, if you want anything to be handed out, it's fine to give it to the clerks, and I would just ask the clerks not to hand it out until the co-chairs would do it.
Thank you. I just have a brief question, because you started out by saying that the standards other than what was the scientific method used in the ASTM standard were not scientific. I would say I've been in contact with Carol Craig, who's the toxic policy coordinator for the Washington Department of Ecology, and their standard is 40 parts per million. And they have looked at this as a PBT, a persistent bioaccumulative and toxic metal. And she feels very confident that their standard is scientific, that they have reviewed the literature. So I'm not sure why you think that some of the states that have come up with standards that are, in fact, lower than what we suggested in Connecticut are not utilizing a scientific method, because I'm pretty sure that she would argue that with you.
Well, I think, too, she would say, if you asked her why they picked 40 parts per million, the answer is they felt that was the lowest amount that they could test to. It had no scientific foundation on toxicological impact or bioavailability. It was the lowest number that they could test to. I have met with her also, and she commented to me after that meeting that if we could go through and show that 300 was just as health protective as 40, then why wouldn't they change? And, of course, that's where we are. We're actively involved in working with them in Washington with other legislators who are behind the standard, and we're actively trying to get them to harmonize as well. There are three states. There's Connecticut, Maryland, and Washington State.
I'm also dealing with Washington, so perhaps we could work together, because I have a lot of colleagues that I've worked with throughout the country at different conferences. So
I would welcome that.
I think that we can make sure that whatever information that is coming out of Washington is in fact consistent,
yeah,
because that is something I think is critical. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I don't know about everyone else, but I found this very, very helpful, and Dr. Ginsburg.
Yeah, before we let go of the latest commentary from Mr. Cleveland. Is it Dr. Cleveland?
No.
Mr. Cleveland. Yeah. So you said that you didn't put a lot of stock in Dr. Weidenheimer's presentation. Something about he might have had surface coatings that were different or paint on it. You know, he was talking about, and he showed us pictures of sandals that were metal without any surface paint on it. We don't know how much plating these had, probably some, and that he did test the components, because he talked about taking several off the shelf and he took them apart and so that he could test one at a time, one component at a time. So I just want to clarify that any variability that he saw, it sounded like he did a careful job of trying to get to the bottom of how reproducible and also how much the marring of the surface would change the result, which clearly in his hands, in his laboratory, it did. And it's something that I wish CPSC ASTM had done so we could compare side by side. I've taken a close look at what CPSC has actually published regarding cadmium and lead extractive testing over a time course. And if you look at samples that were duplicates, one passes, one fails in a duplicate setting. So in my mind, you know, if we're talking about a product that has a high source potential where there is a potential toxicity issue with a small child, I want to be, as a health department official, darn sure that that is not representing a real risk to that child. And to have a migration test, which so far from the data that I've seen, whether it's CPSC's data, whether it's Dr. Weidenheimer's data, whether it's the Montreal Group's data, showing the kind of variability, it doesn't set well if you're putting a lot of cadmium out there on the shelf.
Right.
Now, fortunately, it sounds like the industry has drank the Kool-Aid, and they are not putting a lot of cadmium on the shelf as of today, as of the players in the market that we have right now. And in my mind, regulations will help make sure that that stays true in the future. But relying on a migration test, from what I've seen, if you've got a lot of metal, toxic metal in a product, I'd want to be really sure that that's not going to move in a child's stomach. And as Representative Witko said, you know, what is the physiology and how well does the test simulate the different things that come down the pike that may help digest or migrate or, you know, in the time frame. There's a lot of variables there.
Thank you, and our end game is the same as yours. I would like to say, though, I specifically asked the doctor which he had two graphs that, you know, in his report. I was saying, what component part was that addressing? And that's when he said that he tested the whole piece by itself. You know, he tested everything together, and that that graph was for the results from all of it together. And again, the only problem with that is that if there was paint that he mentioned, and there were rhinestones on one, and again, the paint, if it had cadmium, would release all of that cadmium in a 24-hour test. That's why you only need a two-hour test to actually liquefy the paint. And so if all of that 100% migrated, then, of course, it would skew the results that he would get from the metal.
Yeah, I think his main point was that when he marred the surface, he suddenly got a large release. If it was a surface of paint, you know, if the issue was the paint, scratching a couple of millimeters off wouldn't release any more. So he was clearly scratching into the metal and suddenly saw the large emission.
And last week we talked about the Mutual Cornell testing information. If you have that, you will see the difference between testing the raw piece versus the plated piece in the two examples of the plated pieces to find the correlation there. It's good information, and that also was the basis for the exponent report.
I want to thank everybody. This has been probably the best session for me because I enjoyed listening to everybody's perspective, and it helped clarify some questions that I had. I hope it wasn't too disjointed. I didn't want to run this in a strict fashion. I like the give and take as long as everyone's polite and respectful, and I think that worked well, and maybe we can continue to do that going forward. Before we conclude, what I'd like to, again, urge everybody, a number of people have suggested types of individuals they would like to testify, gastroenterologists, somebody from the industry to talk about the testing and explain the process, and a toxicologist and so on. It's really important that you get those names to us in the next couple of weeks so we can try and schedule those for September. And we will move ahead with that. And again, any information reports that you want, please get that to us. I will, you know, ask the clerks. I know it will take some time. I'm hoping we can get minutes for this meeting so we can try and identify all the important things that were said. I don't know if this was televised, this hearing. It was, so, you know, maybe we can get the link also. I'm watching it. I happened to catch just the other day Dr. Weidenheimer's testimony, and I was amazed how much more I understood hearing him the second time rather than the first time. So I encourage everyone to do that. Let me just ask if there are any final thoughts, Senator Wicklow.
Just a question. We still see
the Thursday seemed to be good for everybody, so.
And probably let's get through Labor Day and look at the last 3 weeks of September. And so, if you get somebody, Senator, then you know we'll, or representative or anybody. I'm thinking let's get through Labor Day. Kids going back to school. I mean, now they go back to school in August now, but whatever.
Diana and I can talk later this week or next week, and maybe we can come up with some proposed dates and then disseminate those, and you can use those dates.
And I think a toxicologist is essential.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If there's nothing else, I want to thank everybody. This was a terrific meeting, I thought, and have a great August. If you're going on vacation, be safe, have a great time, and we will see you in September.